starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. Living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching the coast, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Thursday, April 2nd, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola, and I am broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors or commercial breaks. We also do not have a board operator to take calls. So everything is, this is a one-woman operation. Despite the fact that this broadcast is relatively commercial-free, I do mention my books, which you will find information about at Spingola.com. I wrote the Ruling Elite series that encompasses three books. My latest book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, is available at my website or at Amazon. Please visit ScreeningSandyHook.com for more information about that book. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, created by a good friend and listener. He's just a sweetie. He is just, I cannot tell you how many things he does to help me, and that website is just marvelous, and I so appreciate all of his efforts. All of the more recent files, audio files of my programs, are at that site. These include the RBN files, the American Free Press files, which kind of went defunct a few months back, but all those files are available because of SpingolaSpeaks.net. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola. If you have questions during the program today, just dial in at 646-787-1915. Again, that is 646-787-1915. But please wait until we kind of open the phone lines. Alrighty. We will also be taking comments and questions from the listeners via my email. And that email during the program is comment@spingola.com, or we invite you to attend the chat room. And that is spingola.chatango.com. Again, that is spingola.chatango.com. My guest today is Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of numerous books, including Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947, came out in 2010. Today we're going to talk about another book that he wrote that came out last year. It is entitled Rape, Hate, Sex, and Violence in War and Peace. Now, Amazon sells this book for $25, or you can acquire it from Thomas for $20, postage included, in the U.S. only, and $25 in Canada or abroad. Just drop that amount into his PayPal account, mtgoodrich@aol.com. Tom, welcome to the program. Are you there? No? Yes?
Can you hear me?
Okay, there we go. I had to click you
thanks,
in.
Yeah, thanks, Deanna. Hey, I've got to thank you for the introduction. Also, I've got to apologize to you and your listeners for being elsewhere, basically, while you were trying to hook me up with Skype. So I wasn't there in time, and so now we're going to do it the old-fashioned way with a handheld telephone, but for everybody out there, this is my fault, entirely my fault today. And let me correct you on one other thing, Deanna. The book has been out only a week, even though there was an error
okay.
originally saying it came out in 2014. But it came out last week, and it's
okay.
You know, I was doing it seems like I was writing almost as much about rape and violence as I was writing about history there for a while, and it occurred to me that I was writing almost as much about rape as I was writing about war or Abraham Lincoln or whatever. And so I decided that you know, maybe I ought to put a book together on rape and violence and lust and hate, and how they, when you put them together, they translate into some of the most terrible crimes ever perpetrated in the world. And so that's how that book arose.
I was wondering how I missed it if it came out in 2014. And then we were talking yesterday via email, and gosh, I thought we just need to cover this. And it is available, yes.
Yeah, it was just an accident in publishing, or the 2014 kind of thing.
Okay.
It was just about a week ago it came out. But it's, you know, I believe the impetus for this, you know, I suffered rape as a child. I suffered rape for about 3 years, rape and sodomy. And I suppose that when that happens to a person, there is very little you can do to get away from it. In other words, it becomes a part of you because you think about it, and it's always there. It's like a home invasion that never goes away, every day, every night. Every day, 365 days a year, it's there, whether you like it or not. Sometimes it's at the surface level. Other times it seems to be deep down. But invariably, I mean, as per now, for example, it comes to the surface, and we're talking about it. And so I think it's no surprise that it surfaces in the things I write. I think it would surface if I was a songwriter, and if I was a sculptor or a painter, I think it would surface there as well. It's simply something you cannot get away from. It's a scar on the soul. It's a stab wound that just keeps on giving. And so for everybody out there who suffered this vile, filthy crime that seems to be becoming decriminalized in the American judicial system lately, for all of you folks out there who have gone through this, perhaps you can, in fact, there's no doubt about it, you can relate to what I'm saying right now. And so that's what this book is about. It's come to the surface so often in my writing that I've decided to put a book together and devoted to nothing but lust and hate. And when those two come together, the violent sexual rape that occurs very often from that, whether it's in war or peace.
When I read your preface, I thank you for the PDF file of the book that you sent me yesterday. And I immediately opened it up and I read the preface, and I was just astounded. And I just... I felt so, well, tearful for your experience. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
You know, and the really sad, bad part of it all is, if it was just me, that's one thing, but I have talked to so many people that have gone through the same thing, and my mother went through the same thing. I don't know why, but I would almost estimate, Deanna, that... One in three suffer this, whether it be incest or whether it be a violent rape by a family member, or a rape and sexual abuse of someone who's not a family member, or in schools. And it doesn't seem to be going away. That's the damn part of it. It's no matter how much we broadcast and talk about it, it seems the perpetrators are not listening, or don't care, or cannot overcome this insatiable desire to rape somebody, to hurt somebody, to do whatever they want, irregardless of whether you want it or not. And that's probably why, as much as anything, that I have written about it so much recently. As you know from reading the book Hellstorm, that book... half the book, I think, is devoted to rape. The other half, of course, is devoted to torture and terror bombing and hideous, filthy things that the Allies did in the name of honor and justice and civility. So So this book is basically a purging, more or less, of my own need to basically air this stuff. And back to me, I, you know, most people think rape victims are little girls or women. I would bet that it's, I'm not going to say 50-50 between male and females, but I think people would be shocked at the percentage of boys, men, whatever, that are abused. And somebody brought this up to me, Deanna, a while back, not very long ago. And they brought it up on a radio program when I was talking about Hellstorm and the rapes that occurred. And they were all female. And it's true. That's the material. That's all I had. That's the only material that came to me. And they said, but you know that this was going on with little boys, too, and even young men, and maybe even not so young men. And I'd never even thought of it like that. I mean, here I am, a victim myself, and I'd never really thought of it. Yes, you've got these deviant sadists out there who prefer little boys or men or young men. And so, unfortunately, though, that material did not come to me for that book, or I would have put it in there for sure. But I want to say also thank you for having me. This is, if I'm a little unsteady, unsure of my legs, this is the first time I've talked about rape hate, this book that just came out. You're the first person I've talked to about it. And so just like Hellstorm, you were the first person. Even then, you requested me to come on your program several years ago when I'd more or less given up on the book. And because of that invitation to come on your program, I went to work publicizing the book. So for better or ill, it's all Deanna Spingola's fault that I'm on here today. So thank you again so much for that.
Well, I know that you've probably encountered a lot of people who have criticized you for writing the book, Hellstorm, but it took a great deal of courage. And the minute I opened that book, I knew that I had to talk with you. And I just feel like, well, you're a good friend. And I'm glad that we could talk about this. Oftentimes, these things are hidden away. But even early on, in early warfare, the children and the wives of the people who were subdued in warfare were always considered booty for the victors. And this is true even today, and certainly during World War II. And it's something that we certainly don't want to talk about because it is such a dreadful thing. And as you say, a lot of women have been raped, have been sexually exploited, and so, yeah, it's something that that we do need to talk about. And
you know, during war, there seems to be an unspoken rule, a license that men can do what they want. We're mostly unaware of that. But I've written enough about war and the rape that is a part of war to know that it's unspoken, it's tacit, it's understood. But yes, especially World War II. And let's not kid ourselves. Vietnam, Korea, and right now in the Middle East, stuff is going on right now, I guarantee you. We're just not hearing about it. Let's face it, World War II, you know as well as I do what was going on now in World War II, and this is 70 years later, we're only really finding out about it. So this is going on, and it's an understood. It's a, you know, this is just an anecdote. And by the way, some of the things I'll say today on the program are just me. They're not the historian. They're just things I think about and I sense, I feel. They're not necessarily right or wrong. They're just things that I'm saying. Whereas the history books now, I can stand by those because I'm an expert in those books. But for instance, when I was in the military myself, I had this, I don't know what to call it. He was a sergeant, but he was a real low-life loser type of guy. But he was bragging about Korea and breaking in a new girl over there, a child who, can you imagine the flotsam of war, and basically you're trying to make a living because your mom's been killed or your entire family or whatever. But he had this stupid grin on his face talking about it, and he said that, he was laughing about it. He said, she took off her clothes and got ready to stick it in, and she got scared and ran over in a corner and shit in the corner.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's, when I say that there are people that don't think like we do, there's an example right there, somebody who doesn't think like we do. I don't remember the age, probably 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, I mean, you know, somewhere in there, probably a virgin, and being terrified of this whole affair, but that's the rather truth of war.
Right.
And,
I interviewed a Dr. Mohammad Meraki about the, he was from Afghanistan. He wrote a book called Afghanistan After Democracy. And in that book, he talks about the houses set up for the American military, where they have brought in a bunch of the local female citizens, and that's their job, is to sexually be sexually satisfy the U.S. military, and that is something that we don't hear about at all. And I interviewed Kay Griggs, whose last name is Kay, Pollard. I believe she passed away recently, but she was married to a high-ranking military man, and she produced some tapes, and we talked privately, and she told me that sexual exploitation between the high-level officers and lower-level enlisted men was something that occurred all the time, too. I was just flabbergasted. I think I talked to her last time in 2011 about the things that that go on in the military, and the officers do take advantage of anybody beneath them, literally.
You know, that story about the Afghanistan comfort women. These women.
Right, that's what they are.
In World War II, of course, we know for a fact that the Russians and the Americans and the British and the French were raping German women as they conquered Germany at the end of World War II and after World War II. We know that for a fact. One thing we don't know much about is the other side of the world, America's war against Japan in the Pacific. Now, I've included some of that in this book, Rape Hate. I had never heard about this before, but I'll give you a little example of it. Of course, as the American Marines are island hopping toward Japan on places like Guadalcanal and Truk and these very sparsely populated or uninhabited islands, there's no mention at all in the diaries of rape. Nobody complains, nobody mentions it, because there's, let's face it, there's no people there. But once the American soldier got on Saipan, and then, of course, Okinawa, which are Japanese islands, then the rape began, just like it was doing in, just like it was occurring in Europe. In one 10-day period alone, in one prefecture, that's like a county or something, 1,000 women admitted they were raped by American soldiers. Now, in a society like Japan, where chastity and honor are paramount, they're virtues. These are things the Japanese live by. The fact that even 1,000 would admit to this shameful sin that was committed against them, it tells me that virtually every woman is raped, because that's the way it plays out. And the Americans raped, in fact, one soldier is going by and he saw a group of Marines surrounded a victim, and he thought they were playing craps, but no, they were one at a time raping a Japanese woman. And it went on all the way. And, in fact, when the war was finally over, before the Americans could invade Japan, the Japanese leaders were so concerned about unbridled, rampant rape of their womenfolk that much like Afghanistan and Vietnam and other places, the Japanese themselves took it upon themselves to bring in as many women as they possibly could. And generally they were from the lower rung of life, the poorer people, but they also got as many prostitutes. But generally these were normal women and girls that they brought in to work at these comfort houses. Now, that's what the American publicity machine would call them. And in fact, they were rape stations. It's where Americans could come, give a ticket, buy a ticket for 50 cents or whatever, and basically do what they wanted, which meant rape, violent rape, sodomy, violent sodomy. They could do all sorts of things. And these were tens of thousands. In fact, even though the Americans countenanced this and they encouraged their men to go to these rape stations, which they did, of course, there were still those who preferred taking theirs the old-fashioned way. That's just out-and-out rape. In fact, in Nagoya, American soldiers actually cut the telephone lines one night and went about raping all the women they could get their hands on, hundreds, thousands perhaps, in a hospital in another city, I can't remember the name. They broke into it one night and raped over 70 women, one of which had just given birth to a child, and they threw the child on the floor and it was killed. So, you know, just as they were doing in Europe, they were doing in Japan. And anybody who says differently does not know what they're talking about, trust me. So these rape stations in Afghanistan, that's just a policy that's been going on and on and on. And if for no other reason, women should unite, if possible, and basically take to the streets and demand an end to all war, because it's ultimately they, women and children, who the great sufferers are, and they will always be the great sufferers. If men want to have their own little party, let them go someplace where there are no women and kids and kill each other, but they have to stay away from nations with women and children. And so, but the incidence of rape, now, I the subtitle of the book is, the title is Rape Hate, and the subtitle is Sex and Violence in War and Peace. And as you know, I've included that entire book of the Denise Amber Lee thing in there.
Right.
It's right now, I mean, in space, rape goes on whether there's a war in progress or not. And right now, in my opinion, I think there's a war, an undeclared war against women right now. I probably should include men, boys and men too, because of what we were talking about. But it seems as though that's part of the picture right now. That's part of the program, is to keep women unbalanced, to make sure that they're, I don't know, let me say this, I'm not a doctor, a professor, a scientist. I have not really studied this incidence of rape and it's whether it's growing or receding. I can't imagine that it's becoming less. As a matter of fact, I'm almost positive it's becoming more current. But what kind of a people, what kind of society would basically slap some rapist on the wrist and basically have him out on the streets again in 1 year's time after he's committed a rape? What kind of a people? You know, at one time we penalized rape as it should be. It was a capital offense. You committed a rape against somebody, you're doing more than just raping. You're killing her spiritually. You're killing her soul. It's not easy. It's not fun. It's not something that you can get over. It's not something that you just take a shower and you forget about it. This is something that lasts forever. And that's the way courts treated it. By golly, you do something like that, you turn your penis into a weapon, we're gonna not only take your penis away, but we're going to take your life. You're never going to do it again. I'm all for reestablishing such penalties like that. In fact, I've got a two-strike policy that I would love to see enacted. Two strikes, you commit a violent sexual act like that, and we're taking away your weapon immediately. That is your penis. It's gone. You commit another one with whatever, with an object, with your hand, then we're getting rid of your life, too. We're going to take that away. But this nonsense of raping, abusing, here in Florida especially, I don't take the paper. I used to take the paper. It was always filled with such stuff. You would think that with the awareness and with the number of TV programs that have exposed this pernicious, this epidemic of sexual violence and rape and sodomy. You would think that people would say, oh boy, they're on to us. Now we've got to stop. We've got to back off and develop some fetish someplace else. This rape of women and children, that's not going to work because they're going to put us away in jail. It doesn't work that way. These people are not like us. I am convinced no matter what we do, there's no amount of recovery. There's no amount of regeneration of these individuals. We're not going to cure them of their sickness. They're going to continue doing this. As soon as they get out of jail, they return. I'm talking about the beaches down here, the public masturbators, the guys who like to wag their weasel in parking lots, little girls who walk by, these degenerates like that, who just gotten out of jail that day. That's what I mean by there is just nothing we can do with them except kill them. Or we perhaps put them on an island where they can abuse one another, but whatever we're doing now, it is not working. And I repeat, it is not working. I have not really studied the legal system in the various states, but I'm assuming that it's not working anywhere. It seems to be prevalent throughout the United States, and it doesn't seem to be quite the ugly crime in Europe, although, of course, with the increase of the dark people over there, the incidence of rape, of course, is radically high among those people, especially Sweden. I think, what did they say, 1 in 7 Swedish women can expect to be raped by a colored person, a black person or brown, in their lifetime? Is that
wow.
That is, yeah, and probably it's more than that. It's, you know, in my opinion, I don't even know if murder's a greater crime than rape, because rape, like I said, it's the crime that just keeps on giving. You you shave in the morning, you look in the mirror, and you may not consciously remember that episode, or you put on makeup, and you may not, but it's sort of like a scar. It's always there. It's never far below the surface, and it will surface in times when you... you know, wish it wouldn't, when you're feeling good, and then something attracts your attention that reminds you of that period back then, and there you go again. It's, it is. It's like a home invasion. I've had burglars break into my home before, and it's very much like that. It's something you don't recover from. I'm going to tell you that. And so a murder is so final, and no, I'm not trying to decriminalize murder, for crying out loud. But certainly the penalties for rape, they need to be reexamined, and we need to really go after this. If anybody's really serious about it, if we're not serious, then to hell with it. Just let it go. And we'll have our women living in constant fear, carrying guns and stun guns, and basically living a miserable existence. You know, and I'm not going to blame the usual suspects in this, our Jewish supremacists who have us living in fear, and their pornography industry, and the let's put it this way, yes, it doesn't help, for God's sakes, to see these women trussed up with the spray-on tans and the Botox lips and the boobs that are 10 times the normal size of natural boobs, and always trying to make a come-on with somebody. A lot of men believe that junk. They believe what they see. But what kind of people are we that would just suddenly throw out all of our morals, all of our ethics, to become involved in this business, so-called business, this psychosexual industry that we've got going out there?
Now, do you think that this the coarsening of our values and our language and have led to this? Do you think that it's been incremental? Because I'm sure that 100 years ago, or, well, I'm not sure, but in my mind, I can imagine that 100 years ago or more, we were more genteel. We were people, men were not engaging in such things. But then I contradict what I just said about, or what I said earlier, that rape has always been part of warfare from earliest times forward. So but it seems like it's in our face even more so because of the so-called entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. And look at TV, the way that TV has transgressed from good programming. I Love Lucy, when couple didn't even sleep in the same bed, to where now just about every movie that a person watches or television program, there's always a sex scene. I mean, that is...
You know, Deanna, like I said, I'm not an expert in this. I'm not a scientist. But I do think about stuff like this. I could almost... It would almost seem that the camera was invented by a Frenchman, by the way. The camera was invented basically to take the first pictures of pornography. I could almost accept that because, believe me, some of the first photographs were of women naked and men and women doing things, too. That is way back. It's like 1840s when this stuff starts. I think no matter what, there's always going to be this curiosity, and maybe it's a very healthy curiosity, too, about male and female and what they do. I don't know if that's unhealthy or not. In fact, I can almost guarantee it's not unhealthy. But we also had these ethics and these morals that were in place, and they were fairly well adhered to, by the way, among society. When we were in control of our own destiny, we did have laws. But more than that, we had a society that would ostracize people who were randy and out of control, and a rapist who came along, some monster who couldn't resist, he got strung up. That was as simple as they could make it right there. And that's a lesson they all learned. But now we're not in control of our destiny anymore. Hollywood and our media are Jewish-controlled, and it's in their best interest, of course, to degrade us and make us as much like animals as possible. And I think it's working right now. Yes, we no longer have that ethic or moral, and they've made it seem as though that's quaint and Victorian and out of fashion. And when we try to man up and woman up and be moral, we're ridiculed, we're old-fashioned, we're squares, we're all the bad things you can name. But that's the price we pay for giving up our the control of our own lives. That our job is to take back control of our own lives. And once we do that, yes, then things will sort themselves out. The degenerates, the people who are running around right now, buggering little boys and diddling little girls, they will be dealt with. And there will be such a penalty for it that even those people will get the picture. And we can put that back where it belongs, back under the world, under the ground. But as far as war, I'm a historian, but again, I'm not that comfortable going back too far in world history. I'm not sure. I've got to believe that even though we hear a lot about Vikings and raids and seizing the women and carrying them off on their shoulders into their boats and back to Denmark and Norway and places like that, that looks awfully picturesque and I suppose romantic to some. I'm not sure about all that. I'm not sure about the War of the Roses or the Hundred Years' War, whether rape was part and parcel of warfare at that time. But I know damn sure it was in World War II. Now, let me say this about the Civil War. I've also written some books about the American Civil War, and there is very little about that. Of course, we're talking about the midst of Victorian America, Victorian England, and so it was verboten to speak of such things. And the shame, of course, but I've done probably as much research into the American Civil War as anyone, and I have very little of rape involved. Rape as a weapon of war. Then now, I did write a book about the end of the Civil War. It's called "The Day Dixie Died," about Northern occupation of the South, and rape does start appearing, raising its ugly head in that book. What I'm getting at is I don't doubt that it didn't happen. I don't think it was as pervasive as it became later. But then again, I could be wrong. It's simply that men did most of the writing, that is the journals, the letters, the newspapers. If women wrote more, maybe they would be cryptic and perhaps mention without mentioning the bad things that might have happened to them. I cannot believe that with so many men running loose during wartime that there wasn't something going on there. But it seems
well, Southern women,
more gentle. Yes.
Southern women were a different kind of, they were different than they were in the North. And Southern women would not want to talk about this. And there was an organization, I can't remember the name of it, where they did start reporting following the war about this situation. And so I think there was probably more than what we hear about or read about simply because the Southern women didn't talk about it. Now, I know that there was a lot of slave owners, or the slave owners, the slave owners, they've been sort of only 5% of the Southerners had slaves. But those owners did take advantage of their female slaves.
Mm-hmm. You know, also Margaret Mitchell, she was as much a historian as she was a fiction
right.
writer. And of course, her wonderful book, Gone with the Wind, that's one of the elements in it when the Yankees came through was this attempt at rape. And Melanie,
right.
of course, brought out the pistol and blew the Yankee away. But
yeah.
the fact that, and she talked with people who passed through the war, so she was in a very good spot. So obviously it was, and the scene where the blacks try to rape, which one was it? Scarlett.
Okay, there was Scarlett O'Hara. And Melanie, her sister. Well, let's see. They weren't really related, but they became friends.
It was Scarlett that was in the wagon, the carriage.
Right.
And she came across a camp of blacks and bummers, white bummers, mongrel bunch, and they tried to rape her, tried to grab her. Apparently, she got away, but that's what caused that whole entire Ku Klux Klan scene where the men,
right.
the white men basically are resolved to fix this problem real quick. Yankees are no Yankees.
And right.
that's very much the way it was in the South following the Civil War. We have a very erroneous concept of what the end of the war was like in the South. In its own way, it was every bit as bad as Germany following that war. Those people had almost as much to deal with. I'm talking about the defeated Southern nation had almost as much to deal with as the Germans did. It was one of the more ugly books I'd ever written because it was so diametrically opposed to everything I had thought and believed about the American Civil War. This was not a peace. It was war by other means. And again, that's where rape starts entering my writings, more or less.
All right. Somebody made a comment in the chat room that even now, today, that rape occurs with the male military who actually rape the women in combat with them mm-hmm. in the Middle East, and that some of them actually die of dehydration because they don't want to go to the latrine at night. And they don't drink enough water, and so even the men in the military go after their you know, the people in the military that are supposed to, you know there's it's terrible.
The individuals who signed on for male-female combat roles, there is another place for these individuals. I'm not blaming the women themselves. Some of these women have no other way of making money, really, quite honestly. And so they do what men do, young boys. They join the military. But mm-hmm. anybody with half a brain ought to realize that situations like this are going to occur. And I suppose it is one of the greater scandals right now, if it were broken, if somebody could actually come out and tell what's really going on. But having been in the military once myself, having been 18 once myself, gee, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out things like this. And yes, when you're put in a situation like that, rape is just a given.
Mm-hmm.
It's a given. Whether a woman wants it or not, I mean, it doesn't matter. Where's she going to go? She going to complain? No, it's not going to happen. And so it's got to be one of the more, let me say this, to mothers, fathers, anybody out there listening right now, if your daughter, 18, 19, 20, is thinking about the military, tell her no. Do anything you can to keep her from doing that. It's not the way the commercials make it sound. They love portraying all manners of women and minorities basically succeeding and doing very well in the military in these lousy commercials. But if I would do everything in my power to keep my daughter from joining the military.
Well,
it's
makes
still
it
a man's
like
world, and believe me, if you don't think that, then let her go. Let her find out for herself.
Right.
But anyway, I seem to be,
it
as
is
I
no
always
place. The military is no place for a woman, whether they're in peacetime or combat. Whether you're a female or male, you're patriotized in the government schools to feel that this is a wonderful thing to do, to support your country and to do something wonderful for your country, and you think you're going to travel and it's going to be wonderful. Baloney. It's
baloney.
Terrible.
That's exactly right. And this overly militarized nation that we're living in right now, by the way, a nation that seemingly cannot exist without a war a week, anybody who believes that it's a patriotic duty to go off and fight for freedom 10,000 miles around the other side of the earth needs to go back to school and probably learn a little bit about geography and politics. This has nothing to do with freedom. But back to women in military, I also think that women should never be in a situation. Let me say this. Do we need women cops? I think we do, and I'll tell you why I think we need women cops. We need women cops in women's situations, when you've got domestic disputes, where you've got women doing, I don't know what, you know, bad
talking
things.
Talking with rape victims.
I think they can deal just as well as any man, and probably better. But putting a woman in a potentially dangerous, violent situation with street thugs, that's not the way you do it. That's not going to be a good situation. And if you put them in with a man, it's basically putting that male cop's life in jeopardy by you coming along. Basically what it comes down to is that male, that fully grown man who's the cop, has got a 15-year-old boy for a partner. And that 15-year-old boy can't even handle himself. And so you're going to spend, I've seen it happen too many times. I know cops too, by the way. And you're going to spend more time worrying about them and trying to get them out of jams than you are of actually, taking the bad guys away. Prisons are another place where women should not be, a male prison of all things. If anything is more absurd than that, I'm not sure what it would be. Now, in a female prison, yes, by all means. I think that's exactly where they should be. So I'm not trying to deny women access to jobs and advancement and exciting careers, for crying out loud. Just don't get in situations where it could cost you and your family your life. That's common sense. And war is one of those places, by the way. If women, well, anyway, I'll probably come off sounding very anti-female in this. It's not that at all, I assure you. You know, Deanna, the book Rape Hate, it's, as you know, I start off with the Indian Wars, though, and some things
right.
We've talked about before. And right off the bat, it's people have this wild idea about what the Indian Wars were like, the Indian Wars on the High Plains. We've been told so many times that, these are wonderful people. They're very natural living folks who had great respect for all of nature, and they worshipped here and there. They did all these wonderful things, and they wouldn't think of ever going to war. Well, I did write a book on the Indian Wars, and so I thought it was important to get some stuff in here about Indians on the warpath and what they were really
right.
like. And rape was a component in the Indians' warfare arsenal. And I did research on roughly 12, 15 white women captured by Indians on the high plains of America. And in every case, there is not one instance, by the way, of any white woman ever wanting to stay with the Indians if she had that option. After the cavalry finally came, or after someone had negotiated for her surrender, there is not one woman that I found who wanted to stay with the Indians, that is, stay with their rapists. And by the way, rape was, that was a given. In fact, let me just basically give you a little idea of what it would be like if you were a white woman captured by Indians. First of all, you know, this was after witnessing the murder and mutilation of your loved ones. Your clothes are ripped from your body, and then immediate and violent gang rape, or sodomy, and sodomy, by the way, commence and by however many warriors there are. I mean, it just depends. If they're 30, that's what you're going to get for however long they want to do it. There is no attempt on the part of the raiders and the rapers to understand you and your emotions. Basically, they're raping you. But anyway, if you have any crying children, small children, they're dead pretty quick. An Indian had no reason for taking a child along, and so their heads were bashed against rocks or logs if they were crying. And if they behaved themselves, they might make it, at least. But anyway, if they were killed, they were, chances are the children were also scalped, because Indians scalped everything, even corpses that had been buried. The soldiers and cavalry, they would actually run their wagons over the graves of people who had been killed in the fighting, so the Indians wouldn't know where the graves were at and dig them up and scalp them. But if you're a woman, after the rapes, and they finally give up on that and say that's enough, with a rope around your neck, you're led back to the Indian camp, of course, in a very stunned, naked, bruised, barefoot, bleeding from the vagina, probably. And if you fall down from hunger or thirst, you're just dragged along or whipped mercilessly to your feet. This is not like you're seeing on TV or in any of the movies that I'm aware of. Once you're in the village, you undergo the howls and taunts of the old people, the women and children. They ridicule and they lash you with sticks, and even the dogs, the hordes of dogs that are in every Indian camp, they snarl and bite at your legs. And then pretty quick you're claimed by a powerful man, maybe a chief, maybe not, maybe somebody who's lost his own squaw from illness, death, whatever, and you become his. I mean, that's it. That's your master. Now, just because he owns you and claims you, that doesn't necessarily mean that that he's always going to be protecting you. No, he will sometimes sell you out. He will, depending on your value, how good-looking you are, and how fresh you are, he'll trade you for 10 ponies, 20 ponies, depending on what the buyer is willing to give to have sex with you. And so he's basically your master and your pimp. And by the way, what I mean by just because he owns you doesn't mean you're protected by him. For instance, one of the women I researched, she quaked every time she went for wood and water for her lodge, because she could be raped anywhere from 1 to 6 times per trip. I know that for a fact, because she told an Army officer's wife after she was finally surrendered. In other words, you know, all you have to do is lay in wait down by the creek for her to come by and then rape her, and nobody's going to do anything to you. It's expected. But anyway, when you're in the normal camp life, this has no romance whatsoever. Harlequin romance novels aside, you're worked like an animal. The red Indian, the squaw, she is also worked and beaten too. I mean, it's not like it's just aimed at you, the white person. You will be beaten if you fail to do this, fail to do that. The squaws also are very jealous of you because of the attention you get. But you're expected to carry roughly anywhere from 100 to 300 pounds of wood and logs on your back with straps. Eventually, those wear grooves into your shoulders. And it just never gets better for the person. Now, compare what I've just said to you with some of the movies you've seen, like what's that one with...
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Dancing with Wolves.
Yes, yes. She looks a little bit grimy and rough around the edges, but overall, she looks pretty attractive, pretty marvelous, as a matter of fact. You know, in that chapter where I talk about the Indians, I've got this little question to the reader, basically. I'm going to run that by for a second. In the 1939 movie Union Pacific, a wonderful classic, Cecil B. DeMille, cast of thousands, it won the Academy Award that year. There's a scene where the train is wrecked by the Indians, and Joel McRae, who plays Jeff, and Barbara Stanwyck, who plays Molly, are in one of the boxcars that crashes, and of course it's nothing but splinters, but everybody's been killed by the Indians except Jeff and Molly, but the Indians are closing in. And Jeff knows what's coming. Molly's a little ditzy on this one, but Jeff knows what's happening. He's got one bullet left in his revolver. The Indians are getting closer, and Molly suddenly says, "Listen, do you hear it? Do you hear it?" She's listening to the distance. "It's a whistle. Jeff, they're coming for us. The train is coming to save us." And Jeff, of course, he hears nothing. He thinks Molly's hallucinating. And so he takes that pistol and cocks it and puts it to her head.
Right.
Now, there's another movie 30 years later called Little Big Man. And the opening scene in that movie, one of the opening scenes, is of an Indian raid that has just occurred, and they burned the wagons. And Jack Crabb and his sister Caroline are crawling around at the bottom, waiting for the Indians to come. They know they're out there somewhere, but obviously they're in a real situation. They're very, very close to being killed, they think. But Caroline, she says, "No, they'll save me for a fate worse than death." And she's being very melodramatic about it. She's a young girl, a teenager, really ugly too. And she's going on and on about how terrible this will be once they find out where she's at, because she. But the message she's leaving with the audience, who's laughing at it, is that basically she wants to be raped by the whole damn tribe, if possible. She's so sex starved that she can't wait, even though she's being melodramatic about it. The fact is, I leave it to the reader to decide which one of these, and by the way, Little Big Man also won an Academy Award, and both are very good movies, very fun movies, if not completely accurate. But I leave it to the reader to decide which one of these accounts is more accurate, more honest, more truthful. And then, of course, I begin the chapter of Fate Worse Than Death, and I think it's pretty apparent very quickly that as old and stilted and Victorian as it may seem, with Joel McRae ready to blow Barbara Stanwyck's brains out. And by the way, he didn't kill her because he also then heard the whistle. And the cavalry did come riding on a train to save them, save the day. Still, that was by far more accurate than the 1970 movie Little Big Man. But, of course, by then, Jewish Hollywood had taken over, and we're getting nothing but these things, the movies that would tend to treat white people as if we were some sort of terrible usurpers for destroying this wonderful, peaceful, pastoral, philosophical Indian culture that was the red men on the high plains. And I think that's exactly what the message is that the Indians were in tune with nature. They were perfect. Would they think of harming a white woman? Oh, of course not. Even they would never force themselves upon her. And so I think the message is that the white man was so evil, so bad for crushing this culture in total symmetry with nature. And I believe that's the message. But as historians like myself love to point out, in fact, I guess I'd be out of business if it wasn't for Jewish Hollywood and Jewish media, because it's so easy to poke holes in their rather elaborate little facade, the charade that they're pulling on us. Deanna, I seem to be always monopolizing a conversation with us.
It's okay. You're a storyteller. You are a historian. I shouldn't say storyteller. you are a historian. The account of Catherine German, mm-hmm. how she ever lived, is beyond me. How she ever managed to be able to tell her story is beyond me.
You know, yes, and let's say this. It seems incredible that these women could even think about getting back to normal, and they all try. Some went crazy, unfortunately. When they were finally released, they went absolutely nuts. They went nuts, crazy. They're ready for the insane asylum. But more than not, people like Catherine and others, Fannie Kelly, shake it off. Get back to being, there's no gifts in their life. In other words, you either sink or you swim. And they're determined to swim, even though the shock, the horror of it all is stamped on their face for the rest of their lives. That's the way life was. And so today we've got this idea that the world owes us something, that we're entitled to have a good time or entitled to a free lunch. And when we're not, when we have that withdrawn from us, then we whine and cry and sue and get very angry with our existence. And we turn to drugs and drink and whatever else. Back then, it was, like I said, it was put up or shut up.
Yeah.
You went through a bad time.
Yeah.
Yes, you went through bad times, and there's nothing you can do about it, but you've got to make the best of what's ahead yet.
Sure.
And that's all I can say right now. And let me say this. I told you a little bit about my early problems. As a child.
Right.
I still came from an environment before the entitlement crowd came along, the entitlement generation, this welfare type of thought that, everybody owes you something. And maybe it was easier for my generation to accept it. Believe me, I'm not happy. I could still kill this guy. Easily. And so I don't forget that. But still, I don't think that it's colored or impacted me to the point that I can't go on. Yeah, it's
right.
Been fun for 3 years.
Right.
This, trust me. But I think each generation back, if you looked, they all got along better than the people right now. And it's probably, again, a product of our society that we want to sympathize and pity these people more than encourage them to get up and start over again. I think we've become, I'm not sure about all that. I
think it depends. Depends on the person. Depends on their inner strength. Depends on a lot of things. But I tend to agree with you that bad things happen to a lot of people, and oftentimes we gain strength from our struggles, and we learn empathy for others because of the things that we suffer or have suffered. So I tend to really agree with you that, okay, something bad happened to you, your parents were horrible, whatever the case may be,
mm-hmm.
you just move forward and let those things that happened to you help build you to be a stronger person. You don't cave in to alcohol or other things. And don't, for heaven's sakes, don't take pity on yourself, because you are going to find somebody in a worse situation than what you have suffered. And I don't know.
Very well put, too. And by the way, I'm sure a lot of other people are just like myself. Just because we're getting on with our life, it doesn't mean we're forgetting. I'm not about to forgive or forget.
No.
If I had an opportunity, I would testify this minute. If I had an alternative or an option, I would. There's no way I'm going to forgive people like that.
Right.
Let somebody else forgive them. Let God forgive them. But I'm not going to. Because these creatures, like I said, they're not like you and me. They have no conscience. They have no soul, or they wouldn't have done it in the first place. So they're moving on to more and fresher game, I'm sure. And so we're just perpetuating this. No, back to the punishment part of it. I think once you've been treated like that, then you dwell upon it. You dream about punishment for people like this. putting them on an island is not my idea of punishment, by the way.
No.
Probably death is my idea of punishment for things like this that are so total, so utterly awful. But anyway, that's, again, just my opinions, my feelings of this. And the one, believe it or not, misery does love company. And if I thought I had been the only person that went through this in the world, I'd probably kill myself. I'd probably drown. I'd drown myself or do something. But I know I've talked to too many people, friends, relatives, other people. It comes out all the time. And it's truly a disease. It's truly it's truly pervasive. It's all over out there. I can guarantee you, people listening right now, many people who are listening right now have gone through this before. Some have never ever opened up, have never admitted to it because it's so ugly, so shameful, so disgusting, so repellent. And it's the people who are doing it that. Well, my mother was molested by her father. On and on and on. And I'm assuming that her half-brothers and sisters were also. But I know for a fact my mom was. That's my grandfather.
Wow.
A kindly little old man. I thought he was sweet as a child. Thank God I wasn't alone with him, but had a sweet smile. And by the way, he was one of those who fought in World War II with Patton, one of the so-called greatest generation. No, I could never forgive him. After I found out, of course, it was after he died, my mom was starting to lose it through Alzheimer's, and she finally just told me all about it one awful evening. And you say you've got that blood in you. You think all these terrible thoughts. Well, I've got that blood in me that's capable of doing stuff like that.
Can I interject something here?
Yes.
Tom? I do not think that it is a disease. I don't think that it's genetic. I don't think that is the case. I think when you think of a disease, you think of bacteria, you mm-hmm. think of something like that you cannot avoid. Okay, you get this disease mm-hmm. and you have no choice in the matter. You act upon this disease. No, people have a choice about how they act. They have a responsibility for how they act. By saying that it's a disease, you take away that responsibility. And I do believe it is evil. I believe that people choose to engage in evil because that is their choice. People have free agency, free will, and they make choices on how they relate to other people, how they relate to children who they can easily take advantage of. And as you said, some of the seemingly nicest people are the ones that seem to do this. And I started babysitting when I was 12. And I had two fathers of children who I was babysitting attempt to sexually exploit me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have none of it. None of it. You know, they didn't rape me. But they tried to entice me into thinking that this was something that I probably would enjoy. And mm-hmm. here I was, a 12-year-old.
12-year-old.
Or 13. And I knew instinctively that these people were just evil. And one of them was a heavy drinker, and the other one had served time in prison. I don't know what he did, but the wife told the children that their father was away at college when, in fact, he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a neighbor too, who had a niece, and the niece was from another area in the state, and she would come and stay with this childless couple, these neighbors that lived a couple doors down. And we were, Mary Lou and I were out on the patio, And, you know, we'd put on bathing suits, run through the sprinkler, that kind of thing. And her uncle, Mary Lou, had gone into the house for something, and her uncle grabbed me, and I was just starting to develop. He bit me on my left breast. I never told anybody about it, ever, but I stayed the heck away from that dirty beast. I never put myself in a position to be alone with that guy. And here he was, this wonderful gentleman, supposedly, and people do things because they feel they can get away with it, because they feel that somehow nobody's going to hold them accountable, because they're exploitive. They're not diseased. They're just plain evil monsters.
You know, you're right. Disease, that's throwing a rather broad blanket over these people. I'll say this, that they are mental defects. They have mental issues. They're mentally ill, quite honestly, because no other explanation even comes close. Oh, for instance, for an internet predator to be typing in with little boys, 13 years old, and they're 50, 60, or 70, or whatever, and for them to be busted by cops, and then to go back, I mean, go through this whole, to us, infamy, shame, ignominy, this entire thing, to be drugged through the courts, to be have your photograph on the TV at night. To us, we would prefer death than to go through stuff like that.
Sure.
This guy, as soon as he's out, he's back on the internet trying to get little boys and little girls. That's
they
what I mean by mental. They're so far different from us. No, nothing else could explain it. No, as far as the disease, can I catch it? No. Even though my blood might suggest that I have the capacity to be that. Deanna, as God knows me, I have been just the opposite all my life. Not
you have empathy.
It wasn't
you have
something
empathy
I studied.
For people.
Yes, it's not something I. It's just something I had. So that is the good thing. I don't believe it's. In my case, at least, it wasn't passed on by blood. But certainly, they're different from us. You know. Also, this idea, yes, taking advantage of kids because they can. I was an apprentice photographer for a while when I was right out of college, and I was just looking for something interesting to do. And I was an understudy to this older man. He's probably, you know, at the time he seemed like he was a million years old, but he was probably only about 55, maybe. A very sweet little man, balding, took church pictures. That's mostly what we did, was travel to churches. And mostly his specialty was little kids. And I didn't think much about it. He seemed to talk to the little kids. Okay, sweetie, let's give a big smile. Turn a little bit this way. I'm very good at that, all that. Well, yeah, you know the story. You know the end of the story. One night we went out drinking, and he's showing me these filthy magazines full of little kids and stuff. So, you know, I quit the next day.
Sure. I believe that there are sociopathic and psychopathic people, and they comprise maybe 5% of the population. And these are the people that have no empathy, no regard for the other people in any way, shape, or form. And these are the people that gravitate towards positions, occupations, where they can take advantage of females or other children. They place themselves in these professions. And you can always also, and I've heard it said by people, I think Dr. Daniels may have mentioned this, but he'll find gynecologists, maybe become gynecologists, because it gives them access to legally manipulate women privately, where they would be hauled off to jail if they did that without having a white coat on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard the same things. I've heard that, well, we all know the stories about the scout leaders who gravitate to the Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts,
yes,
to be leaders, just to be around these little kids.
Yes.
I think it's, you know, let's face it, it makes sense.
Yes.
You go where the action is.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I probably shouldn't be saying this, but I also have my suspicion about veterinarians. I think they enjoy, some of them, a percentage actually enjoys the blood and the horror that comes with it. And I speak from a bit of experience on that. I think there's a lot of that going on, and it behooves us to really pay attention, especially when our animals and our kids are involved in things, how we allow others to share with them. Or I don't know about you, but or your situation, but I only had one kid. I waited way too long, my wife and I. But when he came along, I was determined that that child would never be out of my sight for a minute. And no matter what, I was a stay-at-home dad. I was also writing even back then. But the only thing I did agree to was for him to spend time with his grandma whenever she would babysit or whatever,
mm-hmm,
or twice a week at a daycare where he could at least socialize with kids his age, because, like I said, he was an only, just like I was,
mm-hmm,
an only, but I worried about him socially growing up. But everything else, there was no babysitting to it, other people, there was... So I made darn sure that at least while I had him, that I wasn't going to be wondering about what if, Mr. Brown down the street or whatever, things like
sure.
that. But no, your testimony it shows your strength, quite honestly. Your parents must have been good folks, because they gave you that foundation to say, no, I sensed something wrong, and I'm sticking with it. Most kids didn't get that. I can almost guarantee you, I certainly didn't. If something bad happened, you kept your trap shut. And even if you did say what happened, they don't believe you, because it's easier not believing you.
I never told my parents about any of this.
Mm-hmm.
Never said a word about it. And I really, my parents were unique, to say the least. My mother was an alcoholic, and I got the heck out of there as quickly as I could.
Hmm. Gee, that's terrible.
It's okay. It's all right.
But knowing how uncertain your childhood must have been with an alcoholic parent, the floor moves. It's wavy. It never stands still for you.
Exactly.
Constantly seeking approval from others because you're not getting it from mom.
I got it at school. School
really?
was just a wonderful place for me. I that's where I got my approval at school, and through a church that I
uh-huh.
belonged to, and I just really did well in school and got my approval there, and it was okay.
Your teachers were good?
Yes, none of them tried to take advantage of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one counselor, and I got to work in the counselor's office, or got to answer the phone in the office when the clerk or the secretary went to lunch, and so I got all of these bonus kinds of things. And but I remember Miss Mallett; she was terrific, man. She was just when things were really awful, I could talk to her. She wasn't married, but she treated me like a daughter. And I, to this day, I I just am very grateful for the good people that were placed in my life that helped to encourage me and to compensate.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing, but I think most of us can point to a person who was so important in their childhood, and they generally seem to be teachers. I had one myself, Mr. Brown. I was terrified. It was seventh grade. It was right in the middle of this nasty business I'm telling you about. I'd had trouble in school. I was being kicked out about every week, it seemed like. And then I had, of all things, Mr. Brown, a man teacher, coming finally. And I was taunted about that, like, boy, you're really going to get it now. He's a man teacher. You went through all this crap with the women, but wait till a man gets you. And it was just the opposite. Mr. Brown was a man. He, instead of throwing me out of class, kicking me out, basically talked to me. Mm-hmm. Sweet little man, I'm going to tell you, and not for him. We're not talking now. I can guarantee you we're just simply not talking. But Gordon Brown was his name. I don't know how to say it, except, you know, that's as close as a savior comes to me right there, somebody who saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think there's more than that. Anyway, you know, I don't want to talk any more about me. That's fine. And, you know, it's over. Like I said, I haven't forgotten, obviously. And I'm just very sympathetic to anybody who's gone through this stuff. And I know how traumatic it is. And, again, I suppose it's my fighting spirit coming out. We're simply not doing enough to stop it. This isn't... It's not something that has to be. If these people are soulless and have no consciences, and the moment they're out on the street again, they're doing the same thing, well, let's give them a reason not to do it. Like I said, that's where the punishment thing comes in, because nothing else is working. Let's give them a real reason. Let's take away their weapons if we have to, their sexual weapons. If that doesn't work, take away their miserable lives so they don't begin to ruin any more other people out there. We've got nuts. I mean, I'm living in the capital of the United States for sexual crimes. I'm convinced that Florida, there's no other ten states that even come close to the incidents that we have down here. Perhaps it's the beaches. Perhaps it's salt and sand and sun that bring it out. These old degenerates, especially the old degenerates, it seems like they're always 55 to 85, these characters. We had this one idiot down here, and I don't know how to call him anything but an idiot. Some fellow, he was 80-some years old, and apparently he had never got enough female breasts in his life. And so he just never got enough of it. He could have done a number of things, I suppose. He could have went to Hooters and ogled them, but he wanted his hands on. Or he could have actually gone online and with a dating service, but that would just be one set of breasts at a time. So what this degenerate did, he decided he was going to go around giving free breast examinations. He was going to pass himself off as a doctor, and he was going to go from door to door giving free these charitable breast donations. Well, after the first couple of women who actually did allow him...
I can't believe anybody would be that stupid. I'd call the police and, or, you know, whip out my Ruger.
Yeah, this was
my
over
property.
This was over at the Miami area, and I'm assuming they were fairly well-to-do. And I guess it depends on the person. Here's a guy who looks like a doctor, talks like a doctor, and he's being very philanthropic about it. And so, hey, a doctor's a doctor. Why not? And so, but anyway, the first few women that he did, they finally found out that he was really paying a lot of attention to their breasts. And when his hands started quivering and moving to other parts of the body, then they more or less made up their mind that this is a fraud. Well, anyway, this guy, this chesticulator, actually, they did send him away for a year, I guess. And then he's going to be out. He's out now. But out for 10 years of parole. But let's do the math. He's 85 years old. He's been in jail a year. That would make him 86, 10 years parole. The guy's going to be almost 100 years old when he's out on parole. I mean, you'd think that that would be way too old to be pulling things like this. But I have no doubts that he's probably doing it right now, something like that. But Florida, I've heard about degenerates, and you read about them, and you know it goes on. But here in Florida, it's right out in the open. We have beaches here where it's not legal, but people do it. Men expose themselves. They follow people around on these footpaths along the beaches. They follow them, expose themselves, hanging a shingle out, saying, "I'm open for business." I guess that's what they're doing. And we've got so many UCs, undercover cops, whose job is simply to run down these characters. I mean, it's not like we're ignoring that.
Mm-hmm.
These people are always doing it. Our penalties, obviously, are not stiff enough.
Wow.
In other words, until we start actually putting them away for years, not days, fining them until they're broke, or actually, you know, injecting them with some chemical that makes them forget all about breathing, much less about sex. We're just still going to have these people, I think. But anyway, I digress. I apologize.
You know, I just looked at the call board, and I think one of the people that are on the call board are just listening with their phone. But I have a feeling that we do have a question or comment from our listeners. So why don't we go ahead and
fine. Yeah.
832. Are you? Did you have a question? 832. 832. Did you have a question? Apparently not.
Phone number.
Did you have a question?
No, I was just calling in to listen.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Alrighty. Back to listening. Great. Okay. So we have two people on the phone listening. Alrighty. Well, it just that is amazing. I mean, it must be all those retirees down there in Florida that don't have enough to keep them occupied. They have to. It's amazing, but certainly there needs to be some penalties. And the other thing too is that when we're talking about disease or how it seems to go from generation to generation, I had a friend several years ago whose father, how do I say this politely? It was a Jewish family. The father, they had one daughter. He would take her to school, and often I'm so prim and proper. He would compel her to give him a blowjob as he was driving. And one day she threw up in his lap, and she was 17 at the time, and he'd been sexually molesting her in that way for years. And she finally told a counselor, and then she told her mother, and her mother did not believe her. Her mother just absolutely refused to believe her. And so I think that sometimes she actually chose a different lifestyle. She wanted nothing more to do with men ever again in her entire life. And her father passed away, but anyway, she finally reconciled with her mother. But I don't think, you know, the mother didn't believe her. And it was just a terrible situation for her.
Yeah,
awful situation.
Some of the stuff just defies gravity. I told my parents too. And you know what the way it was gonna shake out is that if they believed me, it meant that one of them would have to quit working because somebody, you know, putting me in that situation. And I think they wanted to believe me, but then they were looking for any reasons not. Now, I'm not going to blame my parents because I think, you know, I wasn't equipped to talk about such stuff at
yes.
age.
Yes.
And I had no way of, you know, when you're 8 and 9 and 10, that's your world. It's all you know.
And you think that's probably happening to a lot of other people, and you know
it
that
it seems normal. It,
yes.
Because at the time, Leave It to Beaver was popular, and
mm-hmm.
to me, that was always like it might as well have been science fiction,
mm-hmm.
because it was so implausible in my situation to have these loving, warm parents and a relationship with your brother that's healthy and honest and happy and
mm-hmm.
nurturing. You know, it was like
a fairy tale.
Timmy and Lassie, of course, that's so far out of there that, you know, I could laugh my way through that at that age. But and so a child is very poorly equipped to protest and to scream out loud, hey, this is wrong, guys. And so the fact that you actually did at your age tells me a lot about your character. But again, I don't want to beat up my parents, both of whom are dead. They did the best they could at that time. I think my dad would have killed somebody if he had really believed that. I really do. And by the way, he was my adoptive dad, but I think he would have snapped some backs if he had known what was going on.
Sure.
So, I mean, these type of terrible things happen, and the fact is, though, we're talking about it like it's normal. I mean, we're going along. At some point, this world, this country, this so-called civilization that we have has got to make up its mind. This is not normal. It's not healthy. It's not happy. This is degenerate. It's a filthy, vile situation. We're allowing it to go on. Why? Because I think there's no penalty phase involved in this. You can do it, and we'll let you out with a slap on the wrist, and you can go do it again and again, and we'll have this rotating thing. I almost, you know, we will probably break down as a society, but there also is something in me that wished the cops would just take care of it before it ever gets to the courts.
Sure.
Now, that's the same thing as they used to do, and maybe they still do down in South America, Central America, with some of the death squads. The courts weren't dealing with it, so the cops did. That's pretty much the way I would like to see something happen here. But again, you're presuming or assuming that these cops will all be ethical, and when they do their business, when they do what the courts aren't doing, that they will have society's interests at heart. And not
right.
something, just taking out somebody for a personal reason. So that's how things get messed up. Still, right now with this epidemic that we have going on in America, this sexual violent epidemic, I would like to see something on almost anything happen. For too long,
well,
they've had their own way, the steaming perverts, the degenerates, the log floggers, the kiddie fiddlers, the ones who make a lifestyle of doing it.
Sure. And aren't they trying to, isn't there an organization that says, oh, well, these kids are consensual, and it's a man-boy organization. I can't remember the name of it. But they're trying to say, oh, these kids, they want to engage in sex with older people. And so they're trying to make it legal and trying to say, yes, it's perfectly normal for this to happen. And that the children are choosing to be molested. And isn't that kind of like, well, in some cases I say, oh, this woman that was raped, she just wanted it anyway, just by the way. I could just tell that she wanted it. And the court system, more often than not, it's he said, she said. And so trying to prove rape in a court is a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, because we've got to face it. There are women who would use it to get even with an ex-husband or a boyfriend.
Sure.
Or things like that. There's going to be people who cause problems by that. But nevertheless, it's sort of like the death penalty right now. This does not work. It's not this conviction, the sentence to death row, and then the guy getting fat living there for 20 years on death row.
Exactly.
This is not working. There's no penalty phase in this. In other words, that guy that you know about and I know about who abducted, raped, and murdered this mother minding her own business, this 21-year-old sweet lady, they catch him, never a doubt. He had blood all over his hands, literally. They convict him. That was a given. Send him off to death row, and now he's going to be there for 20 years to think about it, to think about the pleasure this woman gave him when he was raping her, sodomizing her, eating, going out and shooting some hoops with people twice a week, waiting for his appeal to run out. 20 years, hell, half her family will be dead by the time he has finally got the needle put in his arm. That's not penalty. I'm sorry. That is not penalty. I think half the population out there will be dead before this guy is, who's being taken care of at the taxpayer expense. What we need probably is something real simple. I like I said, I'm just shooting from the hip. This is me. But this guy, Michael King, convicted, blood all over his hands, probably 5 minutes after he was given the death sentence, he should have been turned over to the father. And the father has 1.5 hour to do anything he wants with this guy.
Yeah.
Or we could actually put it on pay-per-view and do exactly what, to him, what he did to this woman, including a broomstick up the anus, including all sorts of things. It may be pretty savage, and I agree, it is. It's acting no better than him. But still, I think it would have a very chastising effect upon anybody else who has this type of crime in mind when they see what's happened on pay-per-view, because whatever we're doing now, it is not working.
Right. Well, somebody in the chat room said the prison system is a big business, and that is true. And a lot of the prisons have been privatized, and the people who own the prison receive money from the government for every single solitary prisoner, and so it behooves them to keep as many prisoners as possible, to get as many nonviolent people in prison as possible, and just recently, there was a person that was released from a prison here in Illinois because they now have DNA that they can use. And this guy spent something like 20 years in prison for something that he didn't do. So they use those examples to say, oh, we've got to make sure that this person really did commit this crime, and there's all kinds of appeals and people live on death row for the rest of their lives and die, without ever getting the what they were sentenced for.
I'm going to tell you, there may be something to this. The penal system are big business in this country. Yes, look at them. Florida has 300 units alone. 300 units in the state of Florida. That's a lot of people employed, trust me. And perhaps maybe this has something to do with it. I have drank and I have smoked marijuana. Now, I can tell you, and I've done a little bit of both, that smoking marijuana is far and away a better buzz than booze. I can drive a car, I can do anything I want. Booze, on the other hand, really does get in the way of things, although I've never had any. But my point is, we either need to, I think we probably need to decriminalize marijuana.
Right.
That said, that doesn't mean I'm advocating going out and smoking 3 or 4 joints right now and going nuts, or drinking a gallon of booze and going crazy. But it would sure dampen the load in these prisons that are filled with people who been busted for really small-time petty stuff with the marijuana. And so that would probably, the fact that we haven't decriminalized it may suggest that there's some substance in what you're saying, or the person who wrote in about it being big business, and maybe pornography. We know that that's big business, and that's certainly not going away. In fact, it's increasing, it seems. But again, just the pornography aspect of it, we probably are always going to have these weak-willed, deviants out there who will feast on pornography, and a few of every group will always try to act out their fantasies. They'll see it on porn. I'm not sure. I have not studied that. I don't know what the incidence of is recidivism rate is for those who go back and back and back again to the same sex crimes. I cannot believe pornography is helping.
I think it's greater.
I think
the internet has encouraged a lot more people who probably would never have gone to some of those stores that I hear about, that I've heard about, where you go in the back room and you can look at pornography. Now you can, a married man with kids can get involved with pornography just by surfing the internet and become addicted. And look at the kids who are becoming addicted to pornography simply because it's so readily available on the internet.
Yep. Yeah, that's a fact. And, you know, something horrifying, I won't be naming names, but I've heard recently of little white girls as young as 10 years old going through their menstrual cycles.
Yikes. I think that's a diet issue.
I don't know. I know that in the primitive countries where sex is basically a, I don't know, but I've heard that they mature faster, at least they used to, than European children. But when you start bringing the sewage right into the house and they're accessible, doesn't that start the whole hormones moving way before they should?
Yeah.
That's my thought. Now, I don't know. Again, I'm just shooting from the hip on this, but that's pretty horrific. Nine years old, I think there was a child that actually had a baby at 10 or 9 years old.
Holy cow.
I'm not blaming that all on pornography. Pornography to me, I have surf porn. I will admit that to anyone. I always have a fail-safe, though, and I don't go so far because this is just utterly revolting, some things. I think it is allowing an open sewer to enter your bloodstream by surfing it. Now,
sure.
That said, let me say this. Pornography probably appeals most to people 18 and 25, I would think, because they got raging hormones at that age. And, you know, a guy, golly, Deanna, remember when we were in our teens, we were curious. We were wondering about certain things then. And I'll tell you, since I'm revealing all, I remember myself and a friend. We had there was a dirty pack of playing cards, French playing cards. That's what they said, they were French. And we could buy them for $2. We got together and got our $2, and they were like 52 cards in a deck. And they were all of really vulgar scenes, but this was way back then. So, and, you know, we didn't really have anything like pornography, or certainly nothing like today, but we were curious. We were really curious. I'm not sure what brings that out. But
just simply because you're a human being, and your sexuality is part of being human. But now, when you have children who would never come across anything pornographic, now they can do that. And the problem with pornography, I was reading about it recently, is that when you get so turned on by pornography that having a relationship with a person becomes you cannot have a regular relationship with a person because of your expectations from what you see in pornography. Your expectations are never met by just having, a simple relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even the scenes on TV that we often see, I mean, that is just not how it is. It just isn't how it is. It's an obsession.
It's an absolute obsession. It's a sewage obsession. It's like our all we can do apparently is think about war and fight wars and get ready for war and join the few, the proud, the brave, the Marines, and be a force for good in the world. Join the Navy. It's a welfare warfare pornography state right now, and you're right. Everything is sexualized. Everything's got to be. Have you ever seen cheerleaders lately in basketball games?
No.
I mean, they look like pole dancers. I mean, what they're doing, the generation.
Holy cow! Are, really?
Yeah.
Oh my
gosh. Really. Yeah. And I mean, we have become a nation of sewage, and we're lapping it up apparently. Now, I know how that may sound to some people who are born into it. Who might be 18, 19 listening right now, it may sound like old fuddy-duddies, because that's all they've known, basically, is this sewage. But ask yourself, are you happy? Does this please you? Is there any thought you have above bodily functions? Is there anything you want in the world? Would you like a nice, clean world that actually involves love instead of sex, or peace instead of war? And even young people who were brought up into this filth that we have right now, they just have to be, well, you know, I don't have any real answers for it, except I've got some strong feelings about it, but how do I go about restructuring this world, this sewer we live in right now? Basically, look in the mirror. Get control of ourselves first, then get control of our society. We're the problem. I can go on and on talking about the Jewish influence in America right now, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's pornography, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's TV, filthy TV commercials about race mixing. I can go on and on about that, but ultimately it's me looking in the mirror. That's the problem, because who are we? Are we strong enough to overcome all this, or are we just going to roll over in the face of this deadly assault? It's a deadly assault. Not just the rapes and the pornography, but virtually everything, the spirit. It's crushing our spirit. Are we capable of overcoming this? Deanna, I want to say yes, but I'm not sure.
Well, you know, Auntie Kay in the chat room said the same people did this to Berlin in the 1920s, and that's quite right.
Mm-hmm.
When everything is available, people without conscience... Or they will abandon their conscience, because we all have them. And sometimes we get beyond feeling. In other words, we no longer listen to our inner being, to that spiritual nature that we all have, and we give in to our bodily desires, and we abandon our nature, our good selves, and it's hard to bring it back. Now, the political leaders in Berlin did it in 1930. They got rid of all this. But when you have political leaders who engage in this kind of behavior, then if your leaders are predatory, which our leaders have been for a good long time, our political leaders, it's going to be difficult, if not impossible.
But stranger things have happened. As a historian, I know how quickly there can be a turnaround,
mm-hmm.
A natural disaster of a magnitude that we're not even, have no idea, something like that. On the other hand, I can say right now that there is an awareness. There's the fact that I'm on your program talking like this right now.
Right.
And the fact that so many people are listening. And you have your anecdote you're throwing in tells me that there may be a new dawn ahead. And it may not be as far away as you might think. Have we reached critical mass in this country? Have we become so revolted by the sewage all around us, by this welfare, warfare, pornography state that we live in right now? You know, I'm basically asking myself, do we still have that spark of life inside of us? has it all been extinguished in a flood of pornography and drugs and hatred and war? And probably not. It probably is too soon for a genetic mutation. In other words, you look at the people 100 years ago who controlled their own destiny, who solved their own problems. Well, that's still very much alive in us. Our problem right now is that it's a little hard to maneuver through. I'll tell you what. I know a woman. She's on... No, she's not on death row. She's doing life without parole, however. One of the most brilliant people I've ever met in my life. She's in prison for murder because she killed a girlfriend of a man she loved, a man she considered her master. She was the slave, he was the master. She left home at 17 because of a hateful relationship there with her parents, her mother, and she did what she could. She became a pole dancer. She became a stripteaser artist. She hung around with pornographers. She did some of the nastiest things on earth. She became a slave. She actually wrote it out. And he took her as his slave and did terrible things to her. Nevertheless, there is a incredible spark of decency in her that transcends all we're talking about right now. In other words, those who would love to see us drown in a sea of poisonous sewage, and you know who they are, and I know who they are, the people who hate us the most on earth, the Jewish supremacists who have control over us right now, mm-hmm. They're probably are not so surprised to see a resurgence of integrity and honesty and decency and ethics and morals right now among people just like yourself, people who refuse to drown in that sewage. And I believe it's catching on. I believe there are people who are fed up with it, fed up with the drugs. But back to my lady who's doing life without parole. She's a beautiful woman. Beautiful woman. Her intellect, she's probably got 170 IQ points. She's good at whatever she does, especially graphic arts. She succumbed. She succumbed originally to the sewage, did some terrible things. She killed a person, killed a woman. Who was her enemy? How many more people like that have been thrown away, thrown in the garbage heap, thrown in prison, have done terrible things because they saw no direction at the most important time in their life? In other words, had there been a Deanna Spingola in her life, she might have turned it around and found a way out of this morass that she foundered in. And that's why it's so very important, people like you, and websites that are growing, it seems, every day. There seems to be new directions for us to follow. And fortunately, many are. Many are pulling away. One of the problems I see right now is that the drugs are so pernicious that it's almost impossible for people, unless you've got a superhuman will, to get out of it. Well, I'll tell you what, I was into drugs myself, and I did get out of it. Now, I do have a very strong will, unfortunately, for other folks. I know their wills aren't as great, but, you know, I'm thinking out loud with you, Deanna, because you allow me to. And I get very despondent when I think about all these incredible individuals who are now dying from drug use, abuse, who are in prison, who could be helping the world, could be turning this train wreck around. But again, that's the price we pay, I suppose, for turning over our lives to an alien species who really could care less about us, who really would prefer to see us dead.
Right.
And we're paying for that. And, yeah, World War II, we can go back to that, as we've talked about before. Let's don't go any further. Well, maybe World War I, you've written quite a bit about this yourself, or maybe even the American Civil War. I tend to go to World War II because that was the last chance we had to actually throw this monster off our backs. But then again, here we go. The fact that I'm talking to you says that there's still hope. If there was no hope, that we wouldn't be doing this.
Exactly. And despite the fact that the Internet has a lot of garbage on it, it also gives us the opportunity to talk like this and to meet people who we have commonality with. I would never have met you had it not been for the internet. I might have found your book, but who knows? I heard about your book on another program, a radio program, on RBN, actually. Michael Collins Piper mentioned your book, and I ordered it the very next day, and or maybe that night. So
I would
it
love
gives
to meet
us,
him someday.
He's a terrific guy. Yeah. He really is. But the internet has allowed people like you and me to know about each other, and gives us an opportunity to talk about the things that we've talked about. So,
you know, also when I do come on here, though, it's generally, let's face it, we're talking about some things that are causing real harm, not only in our lives, but our people, the white race's life, livelihood, everything about us is in jeopardy right now. We're facing terrible times. And, you know, wouldn't it be nice, I've often thought this, wouldn't it be nice to have been born in another age where the problems aren't so pressing, that there was time to actually lay in a flower of daisies on a hillside and enjoy the sunlight and never let a terrible thought cross your mind. Just to lay back and enjoy and live life as we think we were meant to live it, instead of the constant, you know, I don't see it as negative, quite honestly. It's a, every generation has faced their challenges. Actually, if you look upon it as a great challenge, a heroic challenge, if you look upon it as your life's work, as something that you can do to save the world, then it doesn't become a negative. It becomes something that it's bigger than yourself. You can fight for it. And more every day I start feeling that way. I feel, you know, we have the people who control us right now, let's face it, our foreign policy, our government, our Congress is no better than a bunch of trained SEALs that are lapdogs to Israel and AIPAC. And if Israel wants something, they get it because our Congress would fall over themselves to give it to them. These are no more our Congress than they are than if they were a group of trained clapping SEALs. Quite honestly, we have lost our ability to lead ourselves. And one of the reasons is, well, the control of the media has been in their hands for over 100 years, and so we had to believe what they said because that was it. There was no other alternative. But you're right about the internet. Now we've got that. Now we've got the power to turn the train wreck around, and we're doing it. People just like yourself. People like me don't get on programs unless they're people like you, and that's where the internet comes in. You know, this idea, too, of calling, it worked in the past when you owned all the media, this name-calling, a classic Jewish tactic, along with psychosexual projection. But generally, the name-calling, a bigot, they call you a racist, a Nazi, an anti-Semite. Why the name-calling? Well, for one, it beats debating. It beats debating in an undebatable issue. And two, name-calling works with most people. Most people fear job loss. They fear ostracism from the society, their family. They don't want to be thought ill by their family. Name calling, however, does not work with those of us who have crossed that line, and we just don't give a damn anymore about what Jews think of us. This is not our issue, and we really don't care what our friends or families think either, as far as that goes. So call away. Call me anything you want. Am I a racist? Yes. Did I begin life that way? No, far from it. But as I grew, I learned my racism from the best, the blacks, the browns, and especially their Jewish enablers in Hollywood, the media, and academia. As a racist, that doesn't mean I hate others. No. But they created me. Now they can deal with me. Now I'm talking on Deanna Spingola's show. Am I an anti-Semite? You bet your bagel I am. Until Jews stop hurting and slaughtering Palestinians like a Texas rancher herds his cattle and slaughters them, until they stop trying to stoke World War III with Russia, until Jews stop staging one false flag after another that results in Americans fighting and dying in wars that benefit only Israel, all around the globe, too, until Jews stop demanding American whites surrender their weapons, until they stop encouraging and defending the flood of illegal aliens in Europe and America, until they stop buying our corrupt politicians to vote for Israel, until they stop with their filthy pornographic industry, until they stop defending abortion, until Jews stop encouraging through the media and entertainment industry the racial mixing of white people with the coloreds. Until all of this comes to pass, then just so long, Deanna, am I going to be a loud and a proud anti-Semite. So call away. Call me any name you want. I still will not give it up. It doesn't work anymore. And I think
anti-Talmudic. Because these people aren't even Semites. They're frauds. Yeah.
Like I said, call me anything you want. I know what I am. I really don't. I'm beyond that. Now, I couldn't say that 10 years ago. No, I was just as offended or sensitive to being called names. In fact, I wanted to be loved, wanted to be liked. This struggle right now is much bigger than my sentiments, my emotions, my feelings. So call away. Call me anything you want. It will not change me one iota. But anyway, sorry to go off on my soapbox like that. I do periodically.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But when you talk about who is behind a lot of the stuff that we have been talking about and a lot of what's wrong with America, you are absolutely correct.
We don't own our souls anymore. Our souls are in the hands of somebody else. And we're told exactly how to feel, how to think, how to believe, how to marry, how to vote, how to,
I own my soul. I own my soul. We have got to not abandon who we are. We can create our sanctuaries within our homes, and we own ourselves. I will not cave in to what they would like me to believe or to do or to be. I will be myself. I will not give in. I own my soul.
More and more people like you, thank goodness. And that's what I mean by the turnaround. And yes, again, one more time, it bears repeating, the Internet. If it wasn't a white nationalist who invented it, it should have been, because we're using this like a weapon. It's true. There are terrible things involved with this, but that's where our discretion steps in. Right now, we have the tools to throw this monster off our back, and the Internet is it. And it's working. Of course, there are going to be attempts to throttle the Internet, and there already have been. But
sure.
It's not going to work. It's not simply not going to work. We'll find other ways. It's contagious. Hopefully,
yep,
I haven't played.
We have to stand up against them by saying no, by refusing to engage in their behaviors or engage in the things that they are trying to flood the United States with. We can not participate in their wars. If nobody signed up to go to war, they wouldn't be able to do this. They would not be able to invade other countries and snatch resources if people would wake the heck up and say, no, we're not going to do your war anymore. We're done. You go fight your own war.
Yeah, let's pass a law that says only old men can go fight. Not guarantee the war will stop overnight. The 18 to 35-year-olds are forbidden. They cannot go to war. Only the people over age 35, and we'll have wars stopping overnight. But, that's not going to happen because it doesn't work that way. Only the young and the dumb need die for this pernicious excuse for a nation.
We just have just a few seconds. Let's give the name of the book, Rape, Hate, Sex, and Violence in War and Peace. Amazon sells them for $25, or you can order one from Tom for $20, postage included. Do that through his PayPal account, mtgoodrich@aol.com. If you can't remember that, just send me an email. And how's that the Hailstorm documentary coming along?
It's progressing. Of course, the timeline gets moved back because that's the way things work. Art is not ecstatic. You must do what you have to do, and Kyle Hunt is doing that. So I think it's going well, Deanna.
Okay. Well, we do have to log off here. Thank you so very much for being on the program today. I so enjoy talking with you. I think you're terrific.
Well, I feel mutual about you. I thank you for having me once again for the 100th time. I enjoy it, always enjoy it.
All righty. Bye-bye.
You're a good soul, Deanna, too, by the way.
So are you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners.
It starts with you and me.